undid at the kind of intersection of psychology and data science, what are the ethical challenges and concerns that arise from the field, and how are researchers responding to these?
Yeah, so I think the main challenge is that most of this research isn't done by universities, it's done in companies by people who are paid 10 times what you would be able to pay them in a university. So our, you know, Facebook patented personality prediction from text in 2012, that's a year before our first paper came out, and no one heard about it, no one knew about it, right? So it goes to show that although this research seemed novel at the time, actually it was already happening in secret in these companies. So for us as an academic institution, it's also, you know, we have the role of training PhD students and then helping them to get jobs in the wild, and you know, that's a very difficult thing to do because the data that's interesting for psychologists isn't sitting in the National Household Survey or in some archive from the 90s, you know, it's in the latest startup or the latest app. So actually getting data like that out of companies is extremely difficult, basically impossible unless you compromise on your ethics and actually work with them, which, you know, we haven't done, but we've been penalized as a result of that because now we can no longer develop certain apps on Facebook, and you know, that kind of brings its own challenge. So when we did the marketing research, I think another example is that we did that with a very clear goal in mind, and it was then written up as a paper. But if we had been a marketing agency, we would have just, you know, made a bunch of money to do it in secret, and that's what people are doing now. Because you mentioned Cambridge Analytica as a defunct data company, but I'd argue that they're still very much alive. All of the people that worked there now work at Facebook or Twitter or ad agency or anywhere else. They're all rebranded. I mean, Chris Wiley has rebranded himself as some kind of data ethics when, you know, he was the architect of some of the most immoral data practices that we've seen, you know, in recent years. So I think, you know, this is the kind of the world of possibility where if you manage your data effectively, you can actually rebrand and move. And, you know, the Firecrest Technologies, Emma Data, all of these companies still exist and are doing what Cambridge Analytica did probably much more effectively because they now know how to hide better as well, so no one's really going after them. So I would say from the ethical challenge is being in a position where everyone else around you is doing what you would like to do for, say, they might do it for personal, you know, for commercial profit, you would like to do it for research reasons, but you can't actually do it because if we now do marketing campaigns or we do marketing related research, that attracts a kind of scrutiny that and a marketing agency using IBM Watson to do the same thing to make money wouldn't attract.
So is there more transparency, would you say, in an academic setting? In that?
Well, I think the kind of people that end up working in that setting typically tend to care more about these things. You know, I think the industry academia divide, you know, is an artificial one. There are plenty of immoral things that happen in universities, and you know, those come with their own pressures as well. So I don't think that's a helpful distinction, but I do think that it's difficult to find people with not only the computational skills, but also the kind of life philosophy around what is ethical and what isn't, and should you do the research just because it's possible, or, you know, is there a kind of higher calling there? So,
great, thank you. And a question for Laurie. So you've had a lot of personal experience with kind of both sides of the internet and I guess the consequences of that. So you were also, as well as your activism with Anonymous. You were involved in the Occupy movement back in 2011, and you work as a surveillance expert, privacy expert. So one question I wanted to ask you is, in your view, is the internet a platform for freedom or oppression, and kind of how can we work with that?
Yes, is the answer to that question. So we like to, when presenting the logical or, is to realise that it's both at the same time, and it's and I presented it earlier as a transition from this libertarian ideal of a frontier where you could remake yourself to this digital feudalism, but actually it's both happening at the same time, and both are evolving intertwined with each other, so we do still have the power to use technology to our advantage. Anonymous and other hacktivist groups kind of carry on from the legacy of a group of people called cypherpunks, and kind of like steampunk and other kind of anyway, but they use the power of technology, the power of the digital tools that are available to wrestle that power back, to be able to communicate securely, to have autonomy, to have privacy. So the tools are available for the subset of people that A, understand the problem, which is unfortunately too few, B, have the wherewithal to find the tools, and C, have the ability to use them and run them, and then D, don't get into trouble for doing so. And so in my case, one of the minor battles that I won along the way was against the National Crime Agency, who seized all my computers when I was arrested in 2013, then found that they couldn't read them all because I applied strong cryptographic protections in my data storage, something that everyone should be doing going forward, because as they said in that Subway ad, if your life is on your phone, if you lose that in the pub, then your life now belongs to the next person who found your phone, or the person who broke into your office and took your work laptop with your privileged data on it. So I was faced with a bit of legislation under the Regulation of Investigation Powers Act, Section 49 REPA, that says that if you do not facilitate access to the data that you've stored securely, you can face 2 years in prison. So I was issued with a court order from the Central Criminal Court, the Old Bailey, saying that if I didn't cough up all these passwords and key phrases, undo the protections that were on my data to help the National Crime Agency, help the Department of Justice kidnap me and lock me up for the rest of my life, then they would put me in prison for 2 years anyway. So I didn't feel compelled. Asking them to send a better sternly worded letter. I actually presented them with 16, no, it was about 12 things that they would have to establish before I take them seriously. And a few of them are technical, is how can you actually prove that there is data here and it's not just garbage? How can you prove that I'm able to decrypt it? At any point, I'm still able to, but the most important one is, do you actually have the power to deputise me to work for you to destroy my life? and so the tools are there, people have created them. Unfortunately, they're open to too few people. And so the work is for us as the technologists to evangelise and to make these tools more openly available. And then you have a similar compromise as Bert was talking about, where so a guy called Moxie Marlinspike, who's a famous cryptographer, he created this signal protocol that you can download the signal app, you can use it instead of text messages. Governments can't read them, the NSA, GCHQ, they read all of your text, they store all your text messages, all of your phone calls are recorded, they're transcribed, they're put in a database, they're categorised, then if at any point you become a person of interest, as I've been, then they will sift through all that data looking for something to use against you. To make that available to more people, he came to a deal with Facebook and created what's known as WhatsApp. A lot of you may use that, even Tory MPs and people in government use that for their planning and scheming. But unfortunately, Facebook, being such a large organisation, was founded partially by the CIA. They didn't like, presented earlier as Cambridge Analytica, sort of had this insight that all this information was useful. They did have the insight, and they were very good at commercialising it. People who created Facebook, or the people not, it's originally made by Mark Zuckerberg to perv on girls at university, but the CIA or clandestine organisations that they channel funds through realised that this would be really useful, because rather than spending a lot of money on phone taps, if you can encourage people to dox, is the term we use in hacking, to submit their own documents in exchange for a quiz that's fun and at the end of it. So the long and short of it is, WhatsApp is now secure unless the US government or law enforcement agency or one of their partners in the Five Eyes English-speaking spy cartel wants it, and so there's a backdoor already written into it. So we're constantly kind of playing a cat and mouse game with this technology. How can we make it available to as many people as possible without compromising it and diluting it? And it's a similar problem that we're facing now with the social network. So I'm part of a group of people that are trying to decentralise the social network so that it's not all in the control of this one organisation that comes to these relationships with governments or sells your data to the privateers of the information economy that are using it most benignly to sell you things, but more maliciously now to manipulate you. And there's this famous quote that was originally a chiefly ironic joke that if you lose the election, then the best thing to do is to get a new electorate. And that used to just be, that was a thing that was so funny because you couldn't imagine it being done. It's now happening. rather than win the conversation on its merits, you manipulate people through micro-targeted adverts until they see a different set of merits, and then you get the election result that you want. And this is very worrying from a demographic point of view. I ran me a little bit there. I don't know if I maybe had some
questions. No, I'm really interested about WhatsApp as well, because I always thought that was the safest thought.
Well, it's the safest, but no, it's not. But it's the one that most people are on. So I guess that was the other point, is that, yes, trying to get people onto Mastodon as a federated replacement for Twitter, there's other things that are a bit like Facebook. The problem is, you can tell people that it exists, you can explain the merits, the benefits, that you control it. If you don't like the rules, you can run your own instance where you make the rules. You have more autonomy over where your data goes, how it's collected, how it's related. But then they say, but are my friends on there? They say, not unless you convince them. So it's we can't organise the Great Escape until we can convince everyone that they need to escape. And then it becomes viable to start it again. So it's a really difficult conundrum for me as someone that is trying to point people towards freedom and self-determination, and they don't want to go because of the network effect. And until there's a critical mass of people that understand the need for this, then it won't happen. And it's a bit like the New World, again, to take this kind of historical geographical analogy. The New World was colonised because a lot of people had strong religious beliefs that they felt were being oppressed. They went over to have the freedom to do that, but we don't yet have quite an understanding in society that if you do not reassert control over your data and how it's used and how you part the role that you play within the greater system, then you are reduced to something like an insect, something like a bee in a hive or an ant in a colony. Until that's understood, people will continue to do, and it becomes harder and harder to make that argument even.
Great, thank you. Just a quick question before I open up to the audience, because I'm quite aware of time, we are getting a bit late, but I just wanted to ask you, Rod, so your work often explores social interaction and digital environments that exploit our preconditioned behaviours. So how do our curated digital environments exploit our inherent behaviours to influence or manipulate our actions?
Well, I think we've just spent this whole session explaining how that works, really. I suppose the interesting thing, though, is to sort of understand that in a way, what we're talking about is a digital incarnation of something that has actually been around for a very long time, you know, and I've certainly been really interested in experiments that were conducted during the 1960s by social psychologists to try and establish ways that people could be influenced or could be directed in a number of ways, and you know, there's a long history actually of social psychology exploring those, and probably now the psychologist that people most know about is B.F. Skinner and his experiments with pigeons to try and train pigeons in a way that Shoshana Zuboff sort of says is a kind of an analogy for the way that we're being trained to use social media. But actually there are a whole host of other people like Solomon Ash and Stanley Milgram and Philip Zimbardo who also looked at these kinds of situations, these kind of, sort of contexts in which people can be co-opted to operate in a way that they are asked and persuaded. So, and in a sense, we're simply seeing a new digital version of it, really. I guess, and in fact, actually, I guess what we might think about, it might be useful for us to actually think about this as a sort of new form of behaviourism, actually. The interesting thing is that someone like B.F. Skinner's work is actually, I'd be interested in what Bess thinks about this, but B.F. Skinner's work is generally, you know, really disregarded, seen as like absolutely beyond the pale, really, a sort of like a kind of new form of totalitarianism. So it's actually very, very interesting to see that on the one hand, his ideas are very derided, and yet on the other hand, they're incredibly widely implemented. We encounter them pretty much every day, if we believe Shoshana Zuboff in the age of surveillance capitalism. So there's some sort of interesting dilemmas there, and there's some continuity, I think, at least since the 1960s, that are for me very, very interesting.
And just with one, just yeah. Output, I mean, you know, the reason we have ethics committees now in psychological research is because of the
yes.
So, in a sense, now we've had Cambridge Analytica and the related things. Where is our ethics committee? What's the new thing that we are going to invent, to protect us from what we've seen happen and what we see reoccurring all the time? So,
yeah. And also, how many of the top marketing firms have an ethics committee within their corporate structure and how do you deal with that?
I remember asking Demis Hassabis of DeepMind a few years ago, you know, what, how they deal with ethics on the project by project basis, and he said they have an ethics conference every 2 years in some tropical island.
I wonder who's monitoring that and evaluating those processes.
Did the ethics committee also get? They managed to. What did they do? They'd had a completely undiverse collection of people that were called out within nanoseconds of like publishing it. Everybody just went, "That's completely unethical. What are you talking about?"
And a few years later, they got access to everyone's NHS medical record without any patient consent. So, you know, I'm not trying to single out one company, but it's always about, you know, it's not about having an ethics committee. It's about whose ethics do you follow. And those ethics are inevitably informed by financial incentives or academic incentives or whatever they might be in the current environment. So my thought is always, how can we change the incentives? How can we change the incentives for users so that they want to you know, protect their privacy or do things in a federated way as opposed to just kind of following the crowd? How can we change incentives for those platforms to actually make it profitable for them to know less about us? Right, so that's the innovation.
I mean, one of the things as well is that, so at the moment, really, the emphasis is entirely on the user. So the idea is the user needs to take action in order to protect themselves. And actually, what's interesting is that if you think about all the other ways in which we, act in the environment, in fact, there's legislation actually that is specifically designed to protect us. So if you want to build a building, you know, you have to follow planning regulations. Your plans have to be scrutinised so that they follow the planning regulations, and that's just seen as a sort of part of the, you know, you're part of your civic duty as a developer producing a kind of something that is going to occupy public space and that people are going to encounter. And the emphasis there, of course, is not on the user of the building or the environment, but it's actually on the person. The emphasis is on the person constructing that environment to actually follow those regulations and to take care. So in fact, the user doesn't have to take care, actually. And so someone like, for example, Joanna Bryson at Bath University says that that's exactly the model that we should be applying to AI and to our digital environments, which are essentially our new, you know, common built environments.
Basically, it's an opt-in, isn't it? Rather than it being a matter of course that you have to opt out, it should be that you have to opt in by choice. So it should be a matter of course that it isn't the case that this is already evaluating and using this system to produce analytics that then drive, you know, that's the principle in the...
I think my challenge to that would be when you only have one choice, you know, and you opt into it, it's not, doesn't have a lot of value, you know. If you had 10 social media platforms,
sophisticated, but it, I mean, essentially, the fact that you're out as an initial standpoint,
yeah,
and you choose how then you
but
whatever
we've all
options
opted
there
into
are.
Facebook, right? I mean, the problem isn't that people
in
haven't opted in; it's that there isn't competition. There's not 10 different Facebook platforms that you can choose which one and opt in to go there.
Oh, absolutely.
It's that all your friends are already in one place and that one place
but there
is
are,
what
but
it
that's
is.
But what I'm saying, there is no option at all. Because if you don't want to agree with these terms and conditions, then often you can't use the app. So the idea that this is, you know, in any way... If we evaluate that and what's just mentioned as a natural course of events that we imagine that we have heard are previously protected, etc. Dubov goes on about this hugely, doesn't she? This is, it starts from the wrong standpoint in the very initial premise.
I'm just going to take a quick question here.
Hi, thank you all so much for a really liberating perspectives. Just to give you a little bit of context, I'm an old friend of Rod's and practicing artist, but I'm also a lawyer. And I'm currently legal director of a project at a big NGO called Glass, and we're doing various things around big tech, you know, a big disinformation project, and we're now trying to move into what we're globally calling deep toxy algorithm. So all of this has been incredibly valuable, and one of my current kind of projects is to try and find ways to dismantle Section 230, but I might go into that with you in detail later. But I've just got a couple of questions. I've got thousands of questions, but I've boiled it down to, which you can basically take your pick from, one is kind of more algorithmic and one is kind of wider. So in October, the UN, the director of the UN said, we're losing control, we have to call for a new Bill of Human Rights, and called it the Bill of Human Rights for the Digital Human, but they don't know what to do. So I kind of wanted to know from each of you, if you could think of a digital human right, like, I don't know, the right to kind of live, which is one of the basic human rights, what would a digital human right look like? And then I was also really intrigued by Rod's description of the asymmetry of the black box. This is one of the things we're specifically looking at, trying to devise regulation that would force transparency on the algorithm. But I think one of the things that's kind of holding us back from understanding what might be the legal way in is we're finding it difficult to conceptualize what would a transparent algorithm look like to someone who isn't a coder, so your average Facebook user. How would we make the algorithm transparent to the general public? So you can either pick what digital human right you propose, or have what does a transparent algorithm look like? I really love answers on this, which will really help me with Monday's work stream. It's really selfish. But at least there is a clear legal organisation trying to do something about this.
What's a transparent algorithm look like? I mean, I think the difficulty is not actually to describe what it does or what it looks like, but to do it in such a way that people aren't so bored they fall asleep understanding it. That I think actually would be the hardest thing, really. I mean, Vess is probably better answering this question than me, because he's got one of these, you know. I don't have one. I just use this for separate.
I don't think that it's a worthwhile goal trying to make machine learning models more explainable if the reason they're not explainable is because the service can only be provided with something that works at that level of complexity. So an example would be with a biometric source, you know, we make a prediction of your personality based on your likes. We can tell you the reason you're this side of average on extroversion is because of liking these things, because they pull in that direction, because people who have liked those things in the past have had higher than extroversion scores on a test. But how useful is that really for you to know? So in a mortgage, you know, let's say you're applying for a mortgage and next year you apply for a mortgage and they ask for your Facebook profile and they predict whether you're a risky person and you don't know why they think you're a risky person, so they deny your mortgage. Clearly in that situation you need to be able to know what it is that made them think that, and they need to be able to justify that it's a reasonable thing. So when it's a very kind of case-specific thing, I think transparency is useful. But transparency in the abstract isn't really useful, because those machine, if you've gotten to the stage that you've made a machine learning algorithm with hidden layers and so on, then by the nature of what you've built, it isn't transparent, and it's not intended to be, basically. So I don't think that works. I think related to that, for the kind of general human right idea, and some of what was mentioned, I think we should have the right to use services without being tracked, but to an equivalent level of service. So on the very basic level, think of the cookie law. This is one of the great failures of the European Commission in trying to regulate data protection rights. You know, they said our cookies, they invade our privacy, they collect data about us. So rather than what they should, you know, how it works currently is that when you go on a website, you get a pop-up and tells you something about cookies and you try and close it, right? And yes, of course, you could reject them and your experience stays the same. What it should have been is that they should have required websites to give a cookie-less browsing experience. And it could have even been side by side, so you see what the difference between browsing with cookies is and the difference and browsing without cookies. And then people would have seen that, you know, when you search for your train ticket and you're in a rush, the cookie is the thing that pre-fills where you're going to so that you catch your train on time. And people could have actually chosen practically whether that's useful enough for them to, you know, have that intrusion of privacy. So I think very often it's not that we don't have regulation. We do have GDPR and other regulations. It's that those regulations can't be effectively enforced, because when it comes to actually fining Facebook for something, you know, the amount of money that they make pays back the biggest fine in the history of the FTC within like half a day. So, you know, I think the point is that we have regulation, we have rules, we know what the risks are. Making things more transparent isn't going to help if there isn't actually a change from the user, the way that the users can use the platform, and if there is no enforcement and no incentive to change whatsoever.
I could add to that. So you can't have cannot have a dialectic of how this works. You can't have a discourse, a back and forth, a negotiation or a system like a court unless you level the power imbalance. So as with during the robber baron gilded age in the USA, where if you worked in a town, in a mining town, you belonged to that mining corporation and you had a choice between backbreaking labour or starvation, and there's a song 16 tons where even the money you made belonged to the things that you bought from the company store, so at the end of the day that poultry allowance goes back, you know, to continue your subservience. So there's two aspects to that. One is the size of the tech giants now, that they actually have more leverage over the government than the government has over them. They've uprooted themselves from the control of taxation and the freedom to operate by being multinational, by arbitrage of different taxation systems and different regulatory systems. So I think, as Lucy suggested, we need to have a serious conversation about breaking them up, just so they're manageable enough that we can have some ability to work cybernetically, so it's a combination of humans and systems and machines, with regulators, with governments, but with people. The other thing is the lack of collective bargaining means the lack of any bargaining whatsoever. So when you're faced with this binary choice, do you agree to the terms of service or not? And no one's read the terms of service. Even, I mean, you're a lawyer, but if you ever read a whole term of service, you have very good things to work related. They're written in a language we don't speak, and we don't have a choice to say yes to this much of it but no to that much. Without that granularity, it's all or nothing, and the nothing means you're not invited to the party anymore, so that's not a fair negotiation. And part of the problem with that is we're not acting collectively, so there is no movement like the trade union movement for digital netizens.
I noted that down.
Really interesting. So we're peons and serfs without representation, facing a power imbalance. People can work on that to break these terms of service into something meaningful. So there is an effort to do that. It hasn't gone too far yet, but it's working on a bit like the Creative Commons system broke down free shareable licenses into something that people could understand. You can use this if you credit me. You can use this, but you can't make a derivative work for private profit. Or you can do whatever you like because I'm giving it up. So we can make progress with that, but we need to be able to work together. We need to bring power down to size so that a bunch of us can say we are going to withdraw not our labour, but our data, our involvement in this machine that gets profitised. We're going to take it and do it to an alternative unless we have some back and forth over this. At the moment, we just have GDPR. And you can actually use that as an attrition. So, as you say, we get recorded 100 times going through the city. You can write to each one of those companies and say, I want that bit of footage. I want my... and I've done this to the police a lot and the other government organisations. You say, I want subject access request and under the data protection that they have to keep everything about you. And the theory is, some of it could be wrong. It could be misleading. As somebody mentioned, you could be getting denied for a mortgage over something that arguably is not a good reason. You're being categorised as risky, and you should be able to wrestle that back and to, you know, have some hand on the pen that writes your destiny. But that's lots of steps to take together.
I just wanted to add your comment about, you know, digital rights. I'm thinking about the 11 million people in this country that are not digitally literate, and what rights do they have, and what we're doing in society to address that. I was also thinking about, in the pursuit of change, that we need to make sure that, you know, we educate young people, and that we have debates like this, and that we need to make sure that there's advocacy and that there's campaigns, and the work that you're doing as a lawyer, parliamentary lobbying, public interest, litigation, research, and investigations that actually inform policy and public debate and public education around what it means to be a digital human, and empowering people around their rights is going to be central to that. Did you have
anything? Something that on digital platforms and on websites, a lot of the time there are tick boxes. And I think that's something that we could challenge and change, maybe make it more of a continuum. I think that would help people who don't feel like they can fit in just one box. That's something that I think is important for digital
citizens.
And I also think, to echo what Lucy's just said, that we need to fight to protect the freedoms, our own freedoms around our data and the ownership of our data in Parliament and through the courts. And I think that we must expose the challenges and the threats to our privacy and our freedoms, our human rights and our civil liberties in a time of huge technological change in the UK and all over the world.
Any more questions from anyone?
Well, I was just wondering, how do you incentivise people to do that? You know, I mean, that's the big issue really, isn't it? I mean, most of us kind of know the way that, and the threats that, you know, that we operate in that context.
Yeah, I don't profess to have any of the big answers to those questions like you. I'm looking at ways that we might be able to re-level the field, the playing field, because I feel that it's completely not balanced and that there's serious work that needs to be done to address this for society. I'm really, you know, keen to explore ways that we might be able to change things, because I think that they're moving in a direction that I feel very scared about.
Yeah, and I mean, my question wasn't really for you specifically, but I guess for everybody here in this room,
sure.
Because, you know, you made a comparison between, extractivism in a colonial context, and data extractivism, I think, is very analogous with that. Yet consciousness raising doesn't actually, or doing the work of consciousness raising, doesn't actually seem to be having much of an impact. And, you know, we've seen that in the recent political climate where, you know, fact-checking what politicians say doesn't seem to make any difference. We know they're lying, we know what they're lying about, we know specifically, you know, the untruths that are coming out, and yet we carry on, or we ignore it, because...
But I don't think those two things are coincidental.
No, I'm not arguing
that
they are at all.
I think there is a manifest sort of... this strategy of disinformation goes hand in hand. I mean, whether or not tech companies, social media and so on are part of that conspiracy, or whether or not they've just afforded the means by which that has been made possible, I'm sort of agreeing with you. I'm totally agreeing with you. But what I'm saying is that there is now a culture where there's a very difficult space to... There's no trust at all. Online media, there's been a deliberate strategy to undermine any kind of multitude of voices that might have made a difference. There is this undercutting, undermining, and it's very deliberate, it's very political, it's very, and the tech companies have kind of facilitated this. And then, of course, this also decimated any kind of collective approach that would have been made possible by this multitude of voices in the first place. So there's a design going on in this that is actually very... It's a bigger question, it's a political question, it's a huge question that's about raising consciousness on all of those levels. It's just systemic in it, it has to be...
But that's exactly it, and the larger question is to do with the nature of activism and what constitutes activism and how activist practices need to expand and grow and become something other than what they once were. Activist practices in the sense of large-scale mass protests are very useful in a way, but they don't necessarily deliver change. Are activist practices supposed to be defensive in the sense that we try to protect ourselves against the ways that, you know, say our data and information could be used? Or should they be more preemptive, more creative, more...
Yeah, we can speak to a lot of this. So as somebody sort of been in the trenches, as someone supposedly involved in Anonymous, and I don't know if people can remember back in 2011, but it was something like a mini insurgency that kicked off after kind of LulzSec was just doing it for the fun. And then there was a lot of this Anonymous-based activism around wrestling back control over this data. And then inspired by Lucy's fantastic VR thing of the oil, or data being the destroyed oil, and what happens when it spills. Like some of the way to it, it's a bit like with regulation and protection of buildings, or most, it's seen in starkest relief, and unfortunately it's topical, with planes. So planes have the highest safety features in the world, because when a plane crashes, it's really spectacular in a horrific way. It gets the news and people die, and so a plane is one of the most regulated machines in the world. Actually a lot safer than being on the roads, and it's because of the effects of when it goes wrong. And so, you know, they wanted to put me in jail for a very, very long time, and one of the charges was trafficking in identity instruments, and that's considered a kind of fraud, just because allegedly I had access to records from US government systems that they had collected into a silo. And the reason it became a problem was not that they had it, but because that silo spilled. And we've seen that with the Cambridge Analytica stuff. It wasn't considered a problem for Facebook to have millions and millions of incredibly accurate dossiers on people that could predict and manipulate them. The problem was when that got into other people's hands and they used it to sway elections, and suddenly there was this disaster and this democratic deficit that we've still not caught up on, even though it's taking control of our destiny. And in my case, having seen some of these data sets and what can be done with them, and having been perceived as a threat for temporarily redressing that power imbalance and putting it into, allegedly putting into the hands of some activists. Just to be clear, nothing malicious was done with this data, but the government saw that as a massive threat enough to try and put people in prison. So the reason this activism hasn't quite manifested is because when it did, it became subject to the most vicious concerted campaign by government against activists since COINTELPRO in the 70s. And a lot of people that I knew in this space are in prison or have been so scared by not going to prison that they will not engage in this activism anymore, because it is rightly seen as a threat when people come to get them on the internet to say we can be a force to be reckoned with.
Well, the Investigatory Powers Act came out of terrorism. It came out of Northern Ireland.
That's right.
Okay, we've got a question at the back.
I think it's such a real issue is the idea of, you know, technological and machine enslavement, and what these things, like the Cambridge Analytica leak, reveal is how we are enslaved. But, you know, that's the issue, not what we can do to kind of mitigate against it. Because we are, and we have been since the 90s when everything became digitized. The link between the what's happening in the election, that you can reveal truths and people don't care, shows that people are brainwashed. And
so you're saying there can be no change?
Well, how do you get outside the system or in the system?
I don't think people are brainwashed. I don't think they're necessarily... I don't think they're given the opportunity to be able to trust it any longer. I think that's a very deliberate thing. That's a very different thing to somebody being brainwashed. You're sort of... If you say brainwashed, then you're suspicious that this person is unable to tell the difference between...
I don't think the data collection is the control
of
subjectivity and perception.
For that matter.
It's about subjectivity and perception, and that's what data does. So getting a hold of someone's data and then understanding their subjectivity allows you then to manipulate their subjectivity. So the chaos that we see happening in the world, it's a business model. That you create the chaos so you control the market.
Sure.
And so the interlink between, you know, capitalism and politics just go hand in hand, and that's where we are. That's what's starting to be revealed because of Cambridge Analytica and other
activists. Just to say briefly.
But I think the thing is that these are the breach points. The big question is, what happens next? So, how do you get out of it?
Yeah, exactly. That's the question I'm asking.
Yeah.
But the most political thing that you can do. But the most political thing that you can do. I mean, sorry.
The capitalist thing in the way of dealing with
democracy. Well, yeah.
And that's really specific and really important. And also, being
specific
about
brain control
is actually really important.
You can have Rod.
Neglected.
So I think one of the things, I mean, the analogy of slavery is really interesting. One of the really fundamental things to understand, though, is that we don't recognise that they're enslaved. It's a soft slavery, isn't it? It's not a hard...
It's not actually being enslaved either. I mean, let's be really specific.
I'm just carrying on with the analogy, right? So and your analogy is very much the analogy that Saoirse Ronan Zuboff uses in The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. What she sort of says, really, is that this is actually about colonising all those corners of experience that weren't previously colonised in any kind of form. And if it's possible to do that in a way where people don't even notice that it's happening, then they're not so much the better, really. So in that sense, the analogy of slavery is not a good one, I think, not helpful, because if you're an enslaved person, then you probably are going to be aware of that and perhaps try and do something about it. Perhaps you know, perhaps at least of the world to try and do something about it. And the issue, I think, in this situation is not that, actually. And it's that actually the people don't have the will to do anything about it because they don't actually feel like they are enslaved.
Can I underline that? I think the most effective manipulation and coercion is the subtlest. When people feel that they're being pushed, and there's a tendency to push back, when they're being coaxed, when they're shown a nice path, and then it's the path of least resistance for them, then that's when it's most effective. And that's why adverts are not in your face. They don't say, you need this. What they do is create something that you might like the idea of that's tangential to the product, and then expect you to connect the dots between the product and that thing that you want to be, that dancer in the room who's loving being watched dancing, or that person who's softly stated and still beautiful. And so the problem is, like the Matrix, is you can't unplug someone until you convince them that the Matrix is real, and there's another way to do it. If I can use even stranger analogy, Wittgenstein, one of his books, he's talking about free will, the philosopher, and someone, you know, paraphrasing a little bit, but someone argues, I'm human, I'm free, I can do whatever I want. And he says, you're about as free as that water in the glass there. And says, well, what do you mean? Well, that the water's just sitting there, but it could be in a river, it could be in a raging torrent, it could be evaporating into steam, it could be forming a cloud, it could be in a tidal wave rushing away a whole village and a city. But it's not, it's just sitting in the cup, because the conditions for it at the moment are to sit in a cup. And you could be running away to join the circus, you could be fighting for the love of someone in some romantic way. You could be rain, but right now we're sitting in here because the conditions brought us to here. So you can only really understand freedom in terms of the environment plus the individual.
Wittgenstein also produced.
I wanted to kind of inject a little bit of hope into the room as well. I think there's two forms of hope. One of which is entropy, which is that people, especially people Cora's age, are already moving away from the behemoths. She's just been given her first phone, and she goes, no, Instagram, I'm not interested. Facebook, I'm not interested. TikTok, stupid. But they do an awful lot of SMSing, and they do WhatsApp, so they're doing a lot of one-to-one. And then the other thing is to stop using it. So I have stopped using it. And the only reason I know about this is because I was investigating someone through Facebook. I saw a message from Rod. So we are running a big arts event, monthly arts event over at Trinity, very close to you. We are not using any social media at all. We were mocked, but the marketing woman just basically laughed and said we won't get anyone there under 50. Mm. We had our first event, freezing cold day, 22nd December. We had over 100 people, and the age range was massive. We did one-to-one, and we said to people, if you think someone would like this, tell them about it, get them to contact us, and we'll send them an invite. So you would have thought, it meant the people who came really wanted to be there. They went, so, you know, you've got to sort of also take responsibility and stop using the systems.
What's that
and
record?
Rely on coincidence, like me searching for something. I'm finding my old friend is always fascinating, and your brilliant work, I feel really good. I found that.
What is the event that you...
It's called Hell or High Water. If you want to come, you can approach me afterwards. I will take your phone number or your email, and we will send you an invite.
Your Facebook.
I don't use it anymore, but I do have a profile because we do a lot of investigations on Facebook. So, yeah, I am a 96-year-old man who lives in Phnom Penh. That's looking really nice. Although I know
have we got any more questions just before we wrap up? One at the back.
Yeah, so if there's so much propaganda in favour of the system, would it be worthwhile doing counter-propaganda? And if it's a shouting match, then shouldn't people on the other side shout back in a way?
You're not going to get no from me on that. Part of the reason some of the anonymous activist things worked was not because of being scary, although being seen to be scary was kind of handy in some ways, but it was actually through being creative and doing tricks and pranks, and it follows from the tradition of the situationalists and the absurdists on the continent, who realised that to break us out of this hypnotic trance, you have to create a situation, you have to create something that is sufficiently novel and different that it engages the creative response in the brain rather than the follow the track, turn left here, go right here, something that you actually are invited to have a dialectic with in your imagination. So I think that's how we shout back, is we create spaces as terrorists up here where the conversation could arise. And be creative in our usage through subvert. And these, the young generation in whom we do have the hope, the reason we have hope from them is because they do not like the dull and the treaded. They want something new because they're still using so much imagination because it hasn't been drummed out of them by tedium and routine. So I think that's where we derive more hope from, is through creativity.
Thank you everyone for coming, it's been really interesting, and thank you to all of our panellists for coming along, it's been great to hear you guys.
Just go. Thank you. Thank you.